Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The term the heartland is often used by politicians in trying to connect with people and also used to define a national identity, often in a way that excludes some people within the country. The heartland has become a term of mythology that defines a place and a people that inhabit it. And in the U.S., it evokes ruralness or a small town, agriculturally and Main Street oriented, overwhelmingly white, religious, and suspicious of the outside world. Historian Kristen Hoganson decided to investigate this idea of heartland through a deep examination of her home, the college town of Champaign-Urbana, where she teaches at the University of Illinois. By taking this micro view through one community, she digs down through layers of community history to the time prior to the arrival of European settlers, and found story after story that belies the mythology of heartland, even as the myth becomes more enshrined as belief. Hoganson is a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana and the author of three previous books on American history. Her book, The Heartland and American History, was named one of the best books of the year by NPR in 2019 and is now out in softcover. Professor Hoganson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
Your book, The Heartland, is an exploration of a notion that's pretty common to nations. Some nations refer to as the homeland, others the motherland or the fatherland. Here in the United States, as much as anything, we tend to speak of it as the heartland. What led to this exploration of this term, heartland, in terms of the United States and what it means?
Yeah, so I think it matters a lot because the idea that there is some kind of inner core is an important part of nationalist mythologies, right? The idea that there is a quintessential America, a real America, as it were. And so that was a major motivation for writing the book, was to kind of drill deep into that concept, to look at the origins of it, to assess the politics of it, and to map the relationship between history and myth, right? To see to what extent do perceptions about the heartland stand up in the face of historical evidence.
Now, in the case of your book, it's an exploration in some way of a micro view of the heartland, the area right around Champaign-Urbana, your home now. I thought that was an interesting choice, considering that the heartland could refer as far south as here in Oklahoma or Kansas or Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana, or even further east to Indiana or Ohio. Why did you choose this idea of this micro view?
Right. So the book is, in essence, about ways of seeing, about ways of understanding our place in the world. And one of the ideas that has been affixed to the heartland myth is the idea that people in the rural Midwest are somehow more local than people in major urban areas or maybe coastal dwellers. And so one of the things I wanted to tackle was locality, what it meant to be local in a global world. And so I thought I would follow a local history methodology, but in contrast to more antiquarian local histories, you know, the kinds of histories that, you know, people were writing in the 19th century that were all about, you know, taking the unit, the town or the county, and then filling in the space in the map. These relentlessly inward-looking local histories that were very exclusionary in a lot of respects, that I would write a local history that was about connection, that didn't just assume that rigid boundaries of jurisdiction would be definitive, but that the locality would be something constituted by human relationships. So I picked the county that I happened to live in as my starting point, but the takeaway is much bigger than the particular stories that I follow, and I follow a number of stories to the ends of the earth. The takeaway is that similar accounts could be written about any place in the heartland, or in fact in the United States, and that every place, no matter how local it might seem, has been constituted by far-flung relationships spinning out across the world.
I'd like to explore that idea of local having to do with the heartland. Are you talking about just sort of people who have been fixed in place for generation after generation? What do you mean by the term local?
Right. So I think the term local often is taken to mean people who have been fixed in place for generation after generation. I think it has been applied disproportionately to farmers and in other contexts to peasants or rural people who are assumed to be just like tied to place because they make their living from the land. And where it began for the Midwest, the idea of people being local was in 19th century local history accounts that kind of introduced the idea of thinking of places as local places. And these local histories emerged also in a time of old settler societies, like the pioneers or their children and grandchildren, gathering to kind of honor the pioneer forebears who had claimed the place for themselves. And in these different kind of local history societies and gatherings, there was also a lot of emphasis on, you know, we're locals, right? That we built this place.
Right.
And in the histories, we literally own it, because in these early local histories, the people who are featured are the people who are major landowners and who wield political power. And the point of these early histories is to enhance their claims to place, in part relative to the indigenous people.
Right.
Who they displaced, but also in the context of ongoing immigration streams, and claiming, like, we deserve special privileges and to be venerated and honored and celebrated because we built this place, we own it, we are the fundamental locals of this place.
Sounds like history's begins when we got here and and ends as long as we're in power.
Yeah, so I think there's this tendency to think in terms of like human history and U.S. history that things started local and became more global over time, right? That globalization is some kind of late 20th century phenomenon that really, you know, took off after World War II or after the end of the Cold War. But one of the things I find in the book is that the Midwest was global before it became local, that the pioneers, by definition, came from someplace else. And the indigenous people they encountered had been profoundly affected by European colonialism, going back to, you know, the earliest days of like the Spanish explorers and French fur trappers, that they were people who had been shaped, the indigenous nations, by years of colonial violence and disruption. And that, in fact, the idea of locality had to be invented out of this stew of bubbling stew of like human mobility and cross-cultural contact.
It's interesting how the concept of mobility applies in one way but not in another, because you begin with the inhabitants that occupied the land that you describe prior to the, quote, pioneers, unquote, who then called that land home, the Kickapoos. The Kickapoos were nomadic, and they came back to that part of Illinois fairly seasonally. And very quickly, we see one of the themes that define your book, The Heartland, the defining quality of locals versus outsiders. And what's interesting is how that's all flipped on its head.
Yeah, so one of the amazing things to me as someone who's a relative newcomer to indigenous history was just how extensive Kickapoo geographies were through the 19th century. That if you go back to the time of Columbus, most Kickapoo people were living in what is now the Detroit, Michigan, Windsor, Ontario area. And because of the violence that accompanied the fur trade, they were forced westward in Michigan, further into Indiana, into what's now like Illinois, Wisconsin. And then they were kicked out of places like Illinois in the 19th century, driven to places like Kansas and Oklahoma. And some Kickapoo went to northern Mexico and established an ejido, or got a community land grant and have a tribal presence in Mexico to this day. But nonetheless, remain connected to other Kickapoo across the diaspora that stretch as far west as Arizona. And there are accounts of Kickapoo who were like performing artists in England in the mid-19th century, of groups that went to upstate New York, to the Floridas, to Washington, D.C. to negotiate treaties. We're talking about like astounding geographies of mobility, even before the age of like railroads and, you know, interstate highways and airplanes. And for Kickapoo people, the very word Kickapoo means the people who move about and walk about. And place has always been very important to the Kickapoos, but also the ability to move freely through space has been important. And one of the things that colonialism meant to them was an implosion of space, that they were forced onto reservations, and they could not leave without passes and armed guards, and sometimes the passes were denied. Some Kickapoos ended up in the U.S. penal system. I mean, this is a system of, you know, that doesn't exist in Kickapoo culture. Quarantines, this is very relevant to now, often fixed Kickapoo people in place. And also things like, you know, boarding schools where their children had to sit at desks all day, and ideas of domesticity where women were supposed to stay at home all day. And the point of all this is that the Kickapoos didn't conceive of themselves as locals before European colonization, and in fact experienced localization as a form of colonial oppression. So the point is that, you know, being local can have very different political meanings depending on how people have been positioned in relation to that term.
But there was also a sense among the European settlers that the Kickapoo were not of this place because they were there, then they were gone.
Yeah, so there was definitely this tendency to try to use indigenous mobility as a way to claim rights for European origin people, right? The thought is they're rovers, they're ramblers, you know, there are all kinds of terminology that was used in the 19th century to try to separate Kickapoos from place and to kind of imply that, you know, they had no place claims because they were seasonally mobile as well as mobile over long periods of time. One of the things in terms of thinking about the mobility is the settler colonists often ignored their own role in making indigenous people more mobile by doing things like burning their corn supplies that they were depending on for the next season, thereby leading, you know, to situations of hunger where people had to move, by violently attacking people, forcing them from their homes. Of the whole removal process is that one reason why indigenous people in the Midwest were mobile was because they were displaced by European origin arrivals.
But of course, that also would have resonance in later generations as new waves of immigrants moved in too, right?
Absolutely. And one of the things, you know, that really jumped out at me in reading some of the pioneer, you know, kind of histories, the antiquarian local histories, is not only do they reference these family connections that extend across, you know, the Atlantic, connecting European origin immigrants to family members in what they call the Old Country. There are also all kinds of references to, like, family members who are, you know, agents of the British Empire in places like India, for example. And these pioneer histories also talk about the kids, right, of these old settlers. And often the kids of the people who settled places like Illinois are then identified as taking up land in places like Kansas and Oklahoma and Manitoba and Saskatchewan. And there are advertisements, you know, to land that's becoming available in the Dakotas and in Western Canada and, in fact, in Mexico. And so the thought is that the, you know, the pioneers and their descendants continue to colonize over the generations, that it's not like a one-time deal, but, you know, something that carries forward over long periods of time.
This gets into another notion of the book, of this sort of perpetuating empire.
Yeah, so empire really lies at the center of the book. I think in a lot of current political discourse, there is a tendency to depict the heartland as somehow vulnerable, right? That its sinister outside forces, foreign forces, have rendered the heartland a victim. And those claims may be politically very powerful, but they deflect attention from the extent to which the heartland has exercised a lot of power and, in fact, shaped the modern world in which we live. And it's not just the industrial heartland that has done that, but it's also the rural heartland as well. And we're not just talking about histories involving the search for export markets, which then, to achieve those goals, often meant that Midwestern farmers were major agitators for things like coaling stations, naval bases, island holdings, you know, such as Cuba and Puerto Rico, for building the Panama Canal. So that, you know, is all in imperial history. But there are other histories of empire that crisscross the Midwest, involving not only issues of indigenous displacement like the ones I've been talking about, but histories of military service, about missionary connections, about bringing in colonial subjects from places like the Philippines to study agriculture in land-grant universities, in various forms of alliance politics in which Midwestern farmers were deeply imbricated in the British Empire in providing the salted meat that, you know, fueled British naval vessels and dislocating people in rural areas of Britain who subsequently became colonists in places like South Africa and New Zealand and Australia. So, yeah, the point is not just a story of innocence. If you look at the global connections that have threaded to the heartland, there are also a lot of stories of wielding power around the world.
My guest today is Kristen Hoganson. She's a professor of U.S. history at the University of Illinois Champaign, and her book is titled The Heartland, An American History. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you do sort of talk about, again, in this micro view of the area around Illinois where you live now, how that part of the heartland was first a beef belt, if you will, and then a hog raiser before it became the grain belt that we think of it now. But I'd like to talk a little about another, you've sort of got into this heartland trait of isolationism. And you found this interesting dichotomy, again, of getting back to what you were alluding to about how the heartland would go out to develop agricultural markets or markets for their agricultural products. This what you call transnationalism in agriculture alongside of this racial and ethnic distrust and suspicion, I suppose, that goes alongside of that. Talk a little bit about this idea of heartland isolationism that we always think of that being a part of the heartland.
Yeah, so in the post-World War II era, there was a lot of talk about the heartland as like the heart of the American isolationist politics. And a lot of that analysis really overlooked the extent to which the Midwest had been historically connected to the other parts of the world and to the extent that it remained deeply invested in various cross-border initiatives, be they like trade connections, issues of access to missionary sites, to, you know, kind of cultural connections to other parts of the world. And I think the idea became fixed to the Midwest because there was this assumption that geography was determinative. And it never would have made sense to call a place like New York isolationist, even though some of the same politics, you know, that were kind of wary of participating in multilateral, you know, treaties or global organizations, those politics existed in other parts of the country as well. But it just didn't seem intuitive to think of like a major port city as a hotbed of isolationism. So a lot of the early writing on isolationism just pinned it to the Midwest in ways that really hid the connections that threaded through the Midwest. So one of the things I tried to do in the book was to get at some of those connections and to focus on connections that were specific to the Midwest, to point out that people who might pride themselves as, you know, cosmopolitans from the coast or from major cities may not have noticed these connections because they're not the connections, you know, that they're focusing on their own, you know, in their own daily lives and ways of viewing the world. So I focused a lot on agricultural connections, including, in, you know, not only the desire for export markets, but also in the role of imports, that farmers in the Midwest imported a lot of the means of production. They were major agents in pressing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to send bioprospectors around the world to scout for promising plant materials. One of which was soy, which is widely cultivated across the Midwest and has been for over a century. They imported a lot of the animal genetic material, including for the cattle industry and the pork industry, importing very expensive pure-blooded animals to improve herd quality. They were densely networked in all kinds of circuits of scientific agriculture, which linked farmers, especially across the North Atlantic. But there were imperial dimensions to all these connections that led to much wider circuits. One of the earliest deans of agriculture at my institution at the University of Illinois was Michigan-born, but he came to the posted Illinois from Brazil, where he had gone to establish an agricultural college, and then he returned to the United States via Britain, via agricultural station at Roth Hampstead, where he felt like he was in the periphery of scientific agricultural circuits. And upon his arrival in Illinois, he thought he was going to build his own empire, and he really talked about his work at Illinois in those terms, that he was an empire builder. And he brought students from places like Mexico, the Philippines, China, India, to Illinois to study agriculture. And then those students developed their own networks in you know, the rural Midwest, where they joined together to share ideas about national liberation against colonial rule. I think when you think of, like, you know, hotbeds of anti-colonial ferment in the earliest years of the 20th century, small towns in the Midwest, you know, may not come immediately to mind. But in fact, these agricultural circuits fostered those kinds of politics.
But certainly politically, this part of the country, especially after World War I, was highly isolationistic. It did not want to join in the League of Nations. I mean, the opposition to the League of Nations, a lot, in large part, was these Midwestern state senators.
Yeah, so that is kind of a narrow view of what isolationism is all about, if it's all about League of Nations politics. And I have to say that even those claims are a little bit exaggerated. So let me tell you the story of Congressman William Brown McKinley. So he represented my district, and in fact, when I moved to Illinois and the street at the end of my block is McKinley Street, I just assumed it was named after the Ohioan.
The president.
William McKinley, who was president, who was an empire builder, right? He's
right.
The president, you know, who was in the White House at the time of the Spanish-American and Philippine-American Wars, who led to basically a protectorate over Cuba and the annexation of Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Guam. And he was definitely an empire builder. Well, it turns out the McKinley Street, a block from my house, was named after Congressman William Brown McKinley from my district, who crossed the Atlantic 30 times before the age of air travel to advance global government, that he was a leader in a group called the International Interparliamentary Union, which advocated for global governance. And he also made a number of trips to the Caribbean, and he circled the world three times, visiting U.S. military outposts in places such as the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Panama, and was an avid empire builder, just like the president. He was the ranking minority member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And one of the fascinating things about his career is not only, you know, his commitment to global governance, but also how, for all of his talk of peace and harmony and human brotherhood, he was also a staunch advocate of empire, right? You know, he really believed in the U.S. mission in places like Puerto Rico. And I think those politics were not unique to him in the Midwest.
My guest today is Kristen Hoganson. She's a professor of U.S. history at the University of Illinois Champaign. Her latest book is titled The Heartland, An American History. But in our last few minutes, you know, the book is an examination of the heartland in terms of mythology and national identity. I'd like to ask a little bit about the heartland in reality today. There's, you know, tremendous problems in parts of the heartland, taking that idea writ large. You know, you have migration crises where a lot of the, certainly on the high plains, a lot of the towns are drying up. Young people are leaving. It's the center of the opioid crisis. You have farm crisis, some of it caused by tariffs, but long-term problems of industrial agriculture. How do you think the heartland's doing today?
Wow, you're asking me this question in the middle of a global pandemic. Heartland is not doing well today, right? But part of the point is that nobody is doing well today, that there is no part of the country, much less the world, that is doing well these days. And I think that underscores the fundamental point of the book, which is that, yes, there are specificities of place in the Heartland, but the Heartland has always been deeply and profoundly connected, not only to the rest of the country, but to the rest of the world.
When things resume whatever will be the new normal, what do you think the issues that's most going to confront this part of the country in whenever that day happens?
Yeah, well, the issues that the book deals with, I think, have to do with what kind of a nation are we at heart. So I think the short-term, you know, kind of political relevance of the book is that we're about to see a lot of references to the Heartland, I'm expecting, in the course of the 2020 election. And I think most of that is really about Midwestern swing states, right? Which way are they going to swing? But the larger issue, insofar as candidates might be speaking about the Heartland or pundits will be speaking about the Heartland, are really issues that have to do more with what the Heartland represents, right? That with the idea that there is some kind of national essence, real America, inner core. And those are issues of insiders versus outsiders, of do we look inward, do we look outward? What is the nature of American greatness, and like where does that come from? And would we do better to conceive of the world through myths that may be very comforting but misleading, or through more open-eyed evidence-based analysis? And I think those are issues for the country as a whole, for the middle of the country, and issues that I think my book unexpectedly really addresses.
What's been the reaction around Champaign and Urbana? What was the reaction to perhaps people in this area reading this history that maybe they didn't know a whole lot about?
Yeah, so I've gotten fan mail for the first time in my life. So I think part of the book is aimed at outsiders who tend to pathologize like flyover country.
Right.
It's kind of, you know, I push back against that. But it's also been really meaningful to people who haven't understood the full reach of their own past, right? Just how sweeping the tapestry is, how rich and complicated, and in some cases astounding, the stories are. And I've gotten a lot of, you know, email kind of messages from people who said, I had no idea, right? That, you know, like the history is far more fascinating than mythology, and you've taken a place I thought I knew and made it seem strange and interesting in really deeply humanly satisfying ways. So that has just been great for me as the author. So the book is about ways of seeing, right? How we imagine ourselves in larger context. And in that sense, I think it's very much relevant to what we're experiencing now, right? We're being asked to shelter in place. Which is something that is profoundly localizing us all, right? If, you know, we can't go out and about as we might typically do, many people are wearing masks, right? And they're not just doing it for their own safety. They're doing it for the safety of others. They're walling themselves in behind, you know, swaths of fabric. But they're doing it for other people in their own neighborhoods, their own face-to-face communities, but also people far away who they will never meet. They will never know what lives they're saving by taking those protective measures. And I think even in a very isolating time, there is a sense of human connections between us across vast distances of space. And I think the book speaks to that, right? It's a way of kind of recognizing some of those connections that have been overlooked.
Well, Professor Hoganson, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you, Rich.
Kristen Hoganson is a professor of history at the University of Illinois Champaign. Her book, The Heartland and American History, is now out in softcover from Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.